might just pull a couple of nice rabbits out of the hat. Can you hear me okay back there?
Ah!
Yeah. So I'm like totally nervous. I totally know that it's come as you are. And so I'm going to share as best as I can. My main deal is I want to reach to the newcomer, people who have been around a while. You know how to do it. And when we share things, we, if we're open-minded, then we learn some more. And so for those of us who have been a while, I hope, something helps put a little wind in your sails if you need it. And for the newcomer, welcome. And I'd like to say welcome to the land of the living, the home of the free and the brave. And the nightmare is over, if you let it be. And I guess I'm going to start out. I was late getting here because I forgot to bring my cards. I'm going to start out with my cards because the picture's worth 1,000 words. You got one, Bob?
I need another one to remind me.
There
you
go. Joanna.
Thank you.
Tina.
Here.
Tina.
Thank you.
Here I am. Pete. My printer ran out, so some of these are black and white. Well, that's what happens in time. I show up and the people that you run into in meetings are like extended family. And so I'm grateful that each of you that is here is here. And I hand out that card because the picture's worth 1,000 words. And I don't want to get like too stumbled up into a drunkalogue, but I want you to know when I wound up, I swore off drinking every morning, and by the afternoon I got started again, and it was always, oh no, not again, and oh yes, one more time. And 20 months earlier, the woman friend that I'd been pretty close to, she drowned in a storm, her car was washed off the road, and the relationship that we had was illicit, it was married, getting separated, and so on. And I met her, her father, her mom, her stepdad, her soon-to-be ex. I'd met these people that were close in her life, but when she was drowned, they never found her body. They found her car, and so there wasn't a memorial. And at that time, alcohol was my emotional response to life, so I didn't have it in me to reach out to them to express condolences or anything like that. So fast forward 20 months, my mom stopped by my workshop, so we noticed she hadn't been happy for a while, and we could see this therapist. And I was 35, and I'm gonna jump back to the day I was born, but I'm gonna jump to when I was 26. I was living in my car, and I got a drunk driving, and I wound up in a recovery house. And I was dotting my I's, crossing my T's, doing my chores, going to whatever meetings I was supposed to. I don't remember being at a meeting except if someone told me go to that meeting, and then if you want to get sober, find out, ask the house person, the manager, if you can stay there. And so I went to that first meeting and asked the house manager if I could stay there, and they said sure, and anyhow, so I got a job while I was there, and the 4th of July came up, and they had the company picnic, and they had the AA picnic, and the whole house went to the AA picnic, and I went to the company picnic. And it had been like 6 weeks since I had anything to drink, so I knew a couple of beers wouldn't hurt me none. And that was when I was 26. So then fast forward 9 years, and I was 35. My friend drowned, and 20 months later, my mom's saying, hey, we saw this therapist, and would you see this therapist? And I'd been thinking about seeing a therapist because I had this total grief from the loss of my friend, and wasn't living. And I called the therapist, made an appointment for the next day. And a lot of people, you hear the stories, and it's just raucous and tumultuous and stuff like that. And when they got to the end, it was like, they wrapped the car around a pole, or they were arrested for this, that, or the other thing, or whatever. And the end of my story is more like in the movie Forrest Gump, is those of you that have seen it, which is probably most of you, there's a scene where this feather is floating down to Forrest on this park bench. And that was like me at the end of my drinking. I just, after 9 years out there, not even trying to get sober, not living my life, I was ready and I was done. And so I called this therapist, made an appointment for the next day, and I knew I was going to have to not drink while I took care of my problems. And I had a couple of cigarettes left and a couple of beers left, and I had those, and I figured, like Ben Franklin, early to bed, early to rise, makes men healthy, wealthy, and wise. And so I went to bed at 10 o'clock, and I couldn't get to sleep, and I got up, and I went to Safeway, and I got a pint of rum and a liter of Coke and a pack of Camel Straights. Came home, and I watched a movie from 11 to 1. I can't remember what it was. And then from 1 to 3 in the morning, it was a movie called The Heart is the Lonely Hunter. And that's what my life was about. And I tipped up, the movie ended, I tipped up the last bit of rum, and the clock said 3:02, and it was October 2nd, 1984. And I saw the therapist that day, and haven't drank since. When I was seeing the therapist, the first week we talked about my friend Laura that drowned, and then she asked me not to drink until I saw her the next week. And I had no trouble to not drink until I saw her the next week. And the next week she gave me a book to read called Under the Influence and talked about alcoholism being a progressive disease, and that the first stage is having a large capacity to drink. Second stage is using alcohol for emotional response to life. I want to, you know, I'm sad, I'm happy, I'm bored, I'm angry, I'm going to show them, I'm celebrating, whatever it is, alcohol was my emotional response to life. Third stage is got to have alcohol to function. And I didn't identify, I thought I was between second, third stage, and fourth stage is wet brain, cirrhosis, and death. So it's a continuum, it's a disease, it's progressive, and either I had it or I didn't have it. And I was able to identify I do have it. And I thought that I didn't have to have alcohol to function, but at the end of my drinking, what I did for a living was I cut rectangles of leather, sewed them onto zippers down at the Arts and Crafts Show on the beach in Santa Barbara, and what people do in psych wards is what I did for a living. And I didn't have to be at a job at a certain time. I didn't have dependents and so on and so forth. So I slept and, you know, I drank, passed out, crashed out, got arrested, whatever. Got arrested a few times. But I didn't have to be somewhere at 7:30 or 8:30 or whatever. I just came to and then eventually got up and then eventually went and got a couple of cups of coffee to go at Kiro's restaurant and a newspaper and a pack of Camel Straights, and sat down on my sewing machine, and by about noon or one, I was ready to start getting some work done. And anyhow, so that was where it was at the end. And so I recognized I was on that continuum of alcoholism. And the next week, the therapist asked me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a brother-in-law that had invited me over the years. And I called him up, and I went to the Tuesday Men's Stag in Santa Barbara, and that was my home group for a few years. I was 4 months sober, and they made me the secretary down there. And I remember, this almost clear as could be, when I first got sober, that the fact that I had a willingness, like I'd sworn, you know, I'd quit drinking every single morning. You know, I'm not drinking today, I'm not drinking today, and started again that day countless times. But this one day came where it was like, just, it was kind of like maybe a big, you know, like a moment of clarity. You know, the fog clearing out a little bit, and my mom says, "Would you see this therapist?" And it was like, you know, I haven't been living my life. I was in high school. I had the top SAT score in my high school. I would have been voted most likely to succeed. I was student body president. I wanted to marry my high school sweetheart, make babies, and figure out life as you go along. I thought that's what people did, and I thought college was for people who needed to be told what to think about. I had, with the top SAT score, I had a, you know, a scholarship to anywhere in the state of California. And I put the paperwork on my dad's desk, and he was up to his ears, and he never filled it out. And I didn't mind because someone else could have that slot. I didn't need it. I could figure out life as I go along. And college was for people that need to be told what to think about. And I was ignorant in lots of ways. And anyhow, so I wanted to acknowledge the passing of Muhammad Ali. Because he was in my time, I was in his time at that time, and I remember when he changed his name and when he was hooked up with Malcolm X, and seeing all the stuff on the TV today was just so reminiscent of, you know, just a brilliant, beautiful person. and lots of people saw him lots of different ways back in the old days, but, you know, you know a person by their fruit. And anyhow, so I want to get to this one part of my story, but I got to start over here. So on the day I was born, I had four sisters, and by the time I was 6 years old, I had eight sisters. And when I was 8 years old, my brother finally came along, so I was one of ten, smack in the middle. It was a big Catholic family. We're like devout Catholic. I'm not a recovering Catholic. I don't, you know, I got lots of value out of that experience, and I haven't gone back to the church in full embrace, but I am in full embrace of, like in the catechism, you learn, you know, why are we here, you know, to know, love, and serve God. And I don't want to freak anyone out because, like, at the end of my drinking, I had an unbreakable, unshakable love of God when I was growing up. It was like God first, being a Catholic. Second was being a Norris, which was my family, and third was being American. And that was the hierarchy of values within, you know, what's important in life and so on. And by the time I got to the end of my drinking, I had disdain for God if there was a God. So the spiritual life that I had today is kind of made from scratch, part from old recipes and part from new ingredients, you know, but it's a good spiritual life. It's like a cake I never would have got to taste if I'd not been an alcoholic. And I remember growing up, I wanted to be able to bring love to life, help people to find happiness or find their value, find their hope, find their soul. I remember along the way in my drinking days, sitting on a rock, I was almost always self-employed. I mean, and when I say self-employed, I mean I'd buy stuff at rummage sales and garage sales and sell them at the swap meet. Or one time I went to this guy's place in Hope Ranch, and he had an orchard, a lemon orchard. He had 154 lemon trees, and they were creating flies on his property. He didn't care about the lemons, but he wanted to get rid of the flies. So I'd pick his lemons, I'd pay him a penny a piece, and I'd go to the local restaurants and sell them for a dime or whatever. And that was, I just got by. I needed a, you know, a six-pack or a 12-pack of Old Milwaukee and a pack of Camel Straights and a gallon of gas and a bottle of milk, and I was situated, and that took $5 or less. And so anyhow, one day in my drinking days, I was sitting on a rock, and it was like it was a Saturday, but in my drinking days, a lot of the time, every day was like a Saturday. So I was sitting on a rock, and it just came to me, too. I remember on two different occasions. One time it came to me that I'm an alcoholic, and it wasn't anything that struck fear in me or anything like that. It just explained it. I was like, oh, that's why I'm not living a life. And, oh, okay. And another time I remember clear as a bell. It's like in growing up in a, you know, a Christian background, there's a saying somewhere in the Bible that says you have to lose your soul to find your soul. And I was sitting on this rock on this one Saturday, and it popped into mind, you have to lose your soul to find your soul. And more than anything, I wanted to find my soul. And so it gave me license to lose my soul and just get as wasted as whatever. You know, lose my soul with abandon, just don't die, and I'll find my soul. And as it happened, that's kind of how it is. So growing up in a big Catholic family, it wasn't all, everything was fine, but it involves a lot of other people, so I'm not going to get into what wasn't fine about it. But there was moments being a boy, you know, the only boy for my first 8 years. A lot of times you're just totally the center of attention, and it's comfortable. I remember being able to carry on conversations with three or four or five people at the same time. And in my life now, I can be pretty brusque with you. If you're asking a question or something, I'll just blur out the answer rather than engage in a conversation or something, because that's what I learned. You don't have time for a conversation. You just express the whatever is up at the moment and express it and ready for what's next. And other times they're having hen parties. I was totally isolated and for no particular reason. And other times I was like locked in my room for misbehaving, and they had a hook lock on the outside, and I don't know, you know, I don't remember how many times it happened, but I remember it happened enough that I put a hook lock on the inside and locked them out. I remember one time they came at dinner time and they'd totally forgotten about me and stuff like that. So it was a mix of, you know, being totally loved, experiencing lots of love and vitality and all this kind of stuff, and then total isolation and so on and so forth. And anyhow, I remember we, like, you know, it was Mass every Sunday and praying the rosary every night. And when my dad was a converted Catholic, and when we prayed the rosary, my dad was around, it was kind of a deliberate praying the rosary. And then when my dad wasn't around, we would speed through it, like sometimes someone speeds through chapter 5, you know, how it works. And anyhow, so it was, but nevertheless, we did it every night. I remember getting blessed at the, like, day's end. Like, one thing about Catholicism that Alcoholics does a much better job at is teaching the person to pray. In Catholicism, I learned this prayer, I learned that prayer, but I didn't learn to pray myself to my higher power. And I did learn that here. So at the end of the day, there was this thing called the relic. There's a circular bottom. Circular bottom and a stem, and then a cylinder, like about 1 inch deep and about 2 inches tall, cylinder like that with a glass face, and it had like maybe a bone fragment and a hair fragment from St. Teresa or something like that, and then a little gold cross on the top of it, and it's called a relic. And so I remember my dad, you know, we would line up for a blessing each night, and he'd, on your head and your heart and your shoulders, and it was a blessing for our life, for our soul, for our spirit, whatever. And that was a constant thing in my life. So I pretty much didn't get into trouble through high school. When I drank, I wanted more. Like, having so many sisters, there was weddings, and I'd go to the wedding, have a couple of drinks, and get cut off. And I was okay to get cut off. I didn't get jonesing or like, oh, I got to have more or whatever. I had a pretty full life going on. I was continually, like, going out with my immediate older sister's girlfriends or my immediate younger sister's girlfriends, and that part of me, you know, we call it our chooser or picker, whatever, that didn't get developed in me very well, because, like, I seldom stopped to think about who I wanted to go out with, who I wanted to meet, who I wanted to see, whatever. It was more being accommodating and stuff like that. But anyhow, nevertheless, there was always stuff going on, and alcohol was a part of it on some weekends, but it wasn't like a major thing. And growing up in the middle of it, like, my dad was gone a lot, and so, what time are we at? Holy smokes. Okay. So growing up in the middle of it, being the one who would, like, go to the grocery store with my mom to bring the 50-pound bag of potatoes to the car and help her shop and do the coupons and all that kind of stuff, or reaching stuff on high shelves, you know, just, or someone wants to talk to you, you know. I don't know why I was resourceful growing up in the middle of that family. What I want to fast forward to, I can't believe the time is flying by so fast. I appreciate y'all bearing with me. I don't know if this is hard to listen to. After high school, like, my sense of direction was always based on someone else needs help with something, and I was always helping. When I was student body president, the high school needed to be accredited, and it was Bishop High in Santa Barbara, and they were short-staffed or something, and they put me in charge of it. And so I could come and go to classes whenever I wanted. It's a 23-page questionnaire that people had to fill out, and I had to collate the results, and I had a committee that I worked with. But nevertheless, I just always had stuff on my mind. When I graduated high school, my high school sweetheart moved thousands of miles away, and I had no idea that she even was planning to go, and she was going to school. I thought we were going to get married and make babies and figure it out as we go along. So I went to City College, and I got a student deferment, and the draft was going on, the war was going on. I graduated in 1967, and it's just, you know, it's a whole long story, and that's why I passed out that card. At the end, I wound up barely connecting the dots, and, you know, I was alcoholic, smoked lots of pot, did some psychedelics, to the point where my, at one point, my brain was, like, totally scrambled, and I forgot my name, and getting into Alcoholics Anonymous was, on the day I got sober, the day before I got sober, I had disdain for God, if there was a God. On the day I got sober, it was some kind of blessing, some kind of gift, some kind of grace. And one day at a time, since then, in God's hands, it's been a restructuring process. It took me 2 years to be able to say the word God. I was okay with higher power. I loved it that the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. I would have been in big trouble. You know, some people identify, so-and-so, I'm a real alcoholic. And when I hear someone say, I'm a real alcoholic, I shudder, because a newcomer like myself, I could say, well, I don't know if I'm a real alcoholic, and go back out and drink some more to find out. And or we're always more or less insanely drunk. I wasn't. It was insane whenever I drank. And this is really the kind of stuff I want to get to, is that when I drank, a craving kicked in. I had this physical condition. And I was sort of handicapped when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I understood the disease when I got here. I understood that it was progressive, and I understood that I have it. And what I didn't understand, that there was a way out. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I found out that people live life without drinking, that loved living life with drinking but couldn't do it anymore, it was like, thank God. You know, I'm really glad Alcoholics Anonymous is here. So along the way, I mean, was, you know, I have a friend, niece in Mississippi, and she's lesbian, and I had a two-bedroom apartment in Santa Barbara. I was renting a room to this woman, Debbie, who's lesbian, and niece was an ex-girlfriend out visiting Debbie. Debbie was sober, and niece was sometimes yes, sometimes no. But niece had a crease in her head, and her and her girlfriend in Mississippi had been having a fight, and the girlfriend pulled out a gun, and the gun went off and blew off a piece of her head, and she was in a coma immediately. She was in ICU for a month, and she was in rehab for a year. And when I met her, she could walk, but had a bit of a limp. She was kind of shriveled on the left side. She could drive a car. Her spirit was vitality galore, just effervescent. You know, when she had her health, she was sailing all the time in the Gulf and all kinds of stuff. So she was very much into living life and vibrant and so on. And we related, because what happened to her, as quick as a gunshot, she went from vitality and full of life and all that stuff to coma that quick. The same thing happened to me, but it was over many years. So like, I'm in high school, whatever, and I'm kind of on to living life and stuff like that. And but I'm alcoholic, so anyhow, but it was a gradual, slow descent, and I didn't even know anything was getting worse along the way. I just, like, I went on strike, like when Robert Kennedy got shot, after Martin Luther King getting shot, and Malcolm X getting shot, and John Kennedy getting shot. This life that I grew up into was disintegrating before my eyes, and the hope and the brightness and the forward spirit of the human spirit and all that stuff was totally disintegrating. When Robert Kennedy got shot, I just checked out. And as it happened with the Vietnam War, I wound up getting a conscientious objector status, and they had a lottery, and I was 199, and they drafted to 195. And if I'd have been drafted, I would have had alternative service. But the descent from where I was to where I wound up, if it happened as quick as a gunshot, I would have been in total shock. Like you do is here. Look back to sometime before you started getting wasted, if there was a time, to where you wound up right before you got here. If that happened that quick, you'd be in a coma. You'd be in total shock. Where am I? What happened? What's my life? Who's this? You know, whatever, and so on. And I share that for the newcomers to, one, allow yourself to, you know, you're in a coma for the first month. You're in maybe not in a coma, but you're in ICU. You know, treat yourself like you're in ICU. You don't have to be coming back to life, connecting all the dots right away, and so on. You know, just be recovering from a life-threatening disease. okay? So I was saying about being handicapped when I got here, because I understood it was alcoholism, and I have it, and so it took me, and also I had a big family outside of AA, and the my embrace of Alcoholics Anonymous is 110% today, but it took a long time for it to become that. And I like to say that Alcoholics Anonymous has come as you are, and I like to share that, like, God put things in front of me and I said yes to. Like, I was walking on State Street a few weeks sober, something like that, and there's shelter services for women, have a card table out there, and there's literature, and I grab a copy of something, and it's a whatever, and later on I get back to my workshop and where I lived and all that stuff was about a quarter the size of this whole room, and that's where I lived, and I had my sewing machine and the cutting table and all that, and I put this piece of paper on top of the pile next to my sewing machine, and then sometime in the next few days or week, I become aware of a long van, a one-ton long van with a roof rack. You know, how cool is that, right? It was $450 and it ran, and I had a bunch of leather. I didn't have any money, but I had another friend at the art show that did leather, and I said, hey, Mary, I need to get this van. I need $450. You need some leather? And she said, sure. So I got the money. Notice I connected those dots, and I got that van, and then some days later, I'm going through my stack of bills and stuff on my sewing machine, and there's this thing from Shelter Services, and it says, you know, donate money, donate time, or check others. I didn't have money, and I knew they wouldn't want a man around, and so I offered them my van. They could use my van, because the woman in trouble, they needed a van to move out of the situation or whatever, so I offered it to them, and I mailed it in, and I got a call the next day. Mr. Norris, this is Carol Echt. I'm the director of Shelter Services, and we're glad to hear from you. And they had a thrift store in Lompoc. They had a big big room in Santa Barbara where they collected donations, and they needed this room cleared out and stuff hauled up to the thrift store in Lompoc. And then they wound up moving to this other bigger building. It's Women's Community Center. And I moved them. And then they had a bigger area, like a room almost as big as this, a garage as big as this, for collecting donations, and they would get calls, and I would go pick up the donations, bring them to the garage, and there was enough stuff, I'd load up this van, and one time, I didn't get a picture of it, but I should have, but I had two sofas on the top of this van, like one this way, one that way, and I did it myself by, you know, just using the angles and, you know, being about, I don't know how much younger than I am now, a lot younger. But anyhow, had it loaded up and to the thrift store and so on, and so I'm, where they moved to was the Women's Community Center, and the Rape Crisis Center was also over there. And so some woman from the Rape Crisis Center sees this guy moving furniture, and, hey, we need a hand moving this. Well, the next thing I know, I'm involved in a fundraiser and so on. And then the next thing I know, I'm 4 years sober, and I'm the site coordinator for a Take Back the Night March. And some of you women, maybe all you women, know what a Take Back the Night March is. But for you guys, you know, it's, you know, women taking back the night, and they have a march, and they get candles, and however I dress, wherever I go, yes means yes and no means no, and supporting that was important. And this when I was site coordinator, and it was just, you know, showing up in life, bringing to life, or being part of it, doing whatever God puts in front of us, whatever our higher power puts in front of us, whatever dots get put in front of us that we can connect, like cleaning the Golden Group, that we're going to get our whole deposit back, or getting this moved over here, getting it set up. You know, countless times we connect the dots and we say yes to life, and countless times we don't. And that's mainly what I want to share about, is the importance, the imperative of connecting the dots however you can, whatever dots they are, as simple as they are, and doing that, and it, one thing leads to another. At that event, I was in charge of lights and sound and restroom access and ropes and wheelchair access, and I didn't have to do all those things myself, but I had to make sure they happened. And I got to speak at it, and I remember clear as could be, walking up the stairs to the stage, and they made me write it out. It was an 8.5 by 11 single space type, but having eight sisters and stuff, I was able to share. And there's like 700 people in Delgado Plaza, and I read it. And when I went up to share it, I was like totally in my heart. And then coming back down the stairs, I was back into logistics so that the women could be involved in the program. They didn't have to think about a thing except the program. And Gloria Allred was the main speaker, and I was like the opening thing for Gloria Allred, and that's all my claim to fame. No, bad joke. Anyhow, one thing leads to another. I'm going to go by that clock over there. Give me 12 minutes. I go to 8 o'clock. So, I was answering the phone at the central office in Santa Barbara, and it was a 4-hour shift once a week. And there was a guy who was bald, John, and he was walking in and walking out to iron his hair out, and it was like, I found out he was the treasurer, and he'd been the treasurer for 3 years, and he was really burned out on it, he was really tired of it. And my higher power said, you know, Bill, you can do that. I can do the math, and I'm honest, and so on. And so I said, yeah, I can do that. Well, so I get elected treasurer. Well, it turns out that John has it on a computer, in what's called a spreadsheet, in what's called Excel, in Microsoft Office, and I have no idea about computers. For me, up until that day, computers are for people who can't figure things out in their head, the same way that college is for people that need to be told what to think about. It's like, hello, you know, top SAT score in the high school doesn't mean you're very deep. But anyhow, I learned how to use a computer. And instead of cutting rectangles of leather and sewing zippers on them nowadays, I build a website and design stuff and have it made and get orders from Hong Kong and or Australia or, you know, whatever and so on. It's not flourishing right now. It's on the ropes right now. But nevertheless, it is God's grace right now. So along the way, I want to share like three or four things real quick out of the big book. It's Miller time. When it's Miller time, it's important for me to remember I'm an alcoholic. Just because it's Miller time doesn't mean, just because I'm an alcoholic doesn't mean it isn't Miller time. But I'm clear as could be, if I drink alcohol, that craving is going to kick in and I'm going to go where alcohol takes me. Anyone has trouble about the third step, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as understand God, just know that countless times I turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol and pot and psychedelics and all kinds of stuff. So to turn our will and our lives over to the care of is nothing new to any of us. We all have done it hundreds, thousands of times. It's just turn our will and our life over to the care of something unseen, unknown. So Miller time, coffee, water. I don't drink soda anymore. It gave me problems with my gallstones. But, so, in the foreword to the first edition, there are no dues or fees whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. We're not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. You know, and that opened the door for me, just wide open. If I lie to myself enough, then I don't belong here. But if I am an alcoholic, there is a way out. And there's bunches of stuff in here I'd love to share, but that's why they wrote the big book for us. They wrote it for the individual, the solitary individual out in Timbuktu in 1939. There is no AA meetings, no meeting directory, no court setting anyone, no VETS program, no none of that stuff. This, with this book in your hands, there's some people say everything, you know, everything is in the big book, and in the big book it says, thus we grow and so can you, though you be but one man with this book in your hand, we believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin. That's all you need to begin, okay? And then on the next page it says, our book is meant to be suggestive only, we realize we know only little. So they're not saying it's all in here. They're saying it's not all in here. It's hardly in here. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. He's not saying, some people say that this is written to the old timers. There was no old timers. Okay? This is written to the virgin, brand new, wannabe sober alcoholic to give them hope and to give them a vision. That's why they call it a vision for you. Okay? So ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order. Obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And that's chock full of stuff. So get yourself a copy. But in memory of Muhammad Ali, I want to read a few things. He said a lot of really smart stuff, okay? And I don't know if this is his own sayings. or he was repeating something he heard that he subscribed to. But, okay, it was about being, I hated every minute of training, but I said, don't quit, suffer now. You know, suffer being a newcomer. And live the rest of your life as a champion. You know? The fight is won or lost far away from witnesses, behind the lines, in the gym, and out there on the road, long before a dance under those lights. He who is not courageous enough to take risks, like being sober, will accomplish nothing in life. It's a lack of faith that makes people afraid of meeting challenges, and I believed in myself. Friendship is not something you learn in school, but if you haven't learned the meaning of friendship, you really haven't learned anything. A man who views the world the same at 50 as he did at 20 has wasted 30 years of his life. So if you carry the view that you have today for another 20 years, you can do better than that. It isn't the mountains ahead to climb that where you're at, it's a pebble in your shoe. If they can make penicillin out of moldy bread, they can sure make something out of you. Only a man who knows what it's like to be defeated can reach down to the bottom of his soul and come up with extra ounce of power it takes to win when the match is even. If my mind can conceive it, my heart can believe it, then I can achieve it. Don't count the days, make the days count. It's not bragging if you can back it up. At home, I'm a nice guy, but I don't want the world to know. A man is his heart. And the greatest miracle, the greatest prize, is found in the heart. And I want to read the poem. It's like from the guy in the picture on the card. To be able to be literate and have hope and have experience. I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, this amount of time it's just enough time to give you a taste that I experience strength and hope. Each of us in this room, if we were sharing tonight, we all have experience. And we all have bad experience. And we all have the experience of being new. And then some of us, I have the experience of 11,000 some odd days or something like that, a boatload of time. And time doesn't mean anything. In the big book, another favorite line is, the pointers were willing to grow along spiritual lines. So I'll read this poem I wrote actually 18 years ago, or 19 years ago. It's called Facelift. And it seems like a lifetime ago, like when I was a kid, I lifted my face for a communion, for a kiss, for a dream, for a friend. By the grace of God in the sea of life and with patience in the world of words, by prayer and creativity, sobriety, friendship, love, and so much more, I lifted my face to the sky. Well, rolled it away from the earth. The sunlight sparkled on my brow, burning the alcohol behind my eyes. Another day of mourning? What? Is this not life the beautiful? Have I forgotten or never knew to live, to smile, to play? I rolled my face away. Not lifted or put on, my tears dried, I let go to lose and then find my soul. I let my face go and the weight of the world and gravity took its toll. My face fell, I had no thought to save it. I lost my smile, my big light heart, my friendships and great goodness too. Life seemed to need a sacrificial lamb. Take me, I'm lost and looking for some meaning. I lifted my face to a beer. Oh no, not again. And tilted it up to the sky. Oh yes, one more time. I lifted my face to the mirror. What happened? Who's that? The person who awoke from my sleep looked on. Looking back was the one who was lost. I then saw my face unhappy, numb, and alone. I don't know why. Excuse me, I don't know my life. I'm wasted. I've somehow lost my soul. The mouth on my face said hello to a very good friend who stopped by. Mom saw me unhappy as usual. She asked me to share with another my sadness, loss, pain, and abuse. I lifted my face to the phone. I dialed for life and a change. I rounded the nightmare's corner to the long road home on the range. When my head hit the pillow that evening, I was ready to give life a chance. No more smokes, no more beer, no more whiskey, just life, love, grace, and the dance. In an hour, I lost my ambition, and off to the market I went for a cig, some rum, and some cola to wind up the time I'd misspent. I lifted my face to a speaker who told me it's okay to be. From wherever I've been and whatever I've done, and to really believe what I see. I lifted my face to the table, sober, sharing, and found better beginning to function, yet a long ways to coming around. I lifted my face to another, and then a friend who happened to pass. I rose in honest celebration while life was still kicking my ass. I learned that a smile is a facelift, a stretch from one's heart through the cheeks, tugging from deep in the soul and lifting the lips at the crease. My heart is grooving from walking, the long stretch and deep silence it takes, and with effortless neural connection, the warm smile on my weak face it makes. I lift my face to the sky, to the blue, the clouds and the sun, to the rain, to the birds and to heaven, and by God, it is time for some fun. I lift up my face to you. By grace, your smile walks my heart. By you and by countless others, my smile is beginning to start. Thanks for the chance to share, and love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to say that I did begin to call my higher power God when I was a couple years sober. Before I came to believe a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, I believe you guys believe, some people here believe that, and I came to the point where I can tell my higher power, I love you, I trust you, and I thank you. It took me a long time to say thank you to my higher power, and the next thing I was able to say, thank you and I love you, and then eventually I was able to say thank you, I love you, and I trust you, and that's to my higher power. Thank you.
Let's thank Billy again, please.
Thank you, Patrick, and thank you one and all for being here. Thanks again, Billy. I certainly appreciate it. I'm going to take a little time.